Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the December 14th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Well, quite apart from those who routinely become victims of Washington's imperial aggression, these last 2 weeks have not been easy for President Obama and his administration. Beginning with an air attack by U.S. helicopters on November that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers in their base on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, for which the president refused to apologize. Pakistan has shut down the crucial U.S.-NATO supply route into Afghanistan, forced the U.S. to evacuate its equally critical drone launching base at Shamsi in Pakistan, threatened to shoot down any foreign plane that penetrated its airspace, and refused to attend a long-planned conference in Bonn, Germany that was intended to discuss the future of Afghanistan. That came on the heels of Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. being forced to resign when he became identified as the person responsible for a secret memo to former U.S. Chief of Staff Mike Mullen offering in the name of Pakistani President Ali Zardari to reorder the Pakistani military and intelligence services so as to make them more amenable to Washington's dictates. On top of that, while the Israeli-controlled U.S. Congress is in the process of voting for sanctions intended to totally shut down Iran's economy that are far more punitive than any previously employed by the U.S., and doing so over the expressed opposition of the White House, State, and Defense Departments, one of the CIA's most precious spy drones was either shot down or forced to land inside Iran and has provided a propaganda windfall for the Tehran government. And in an astonishing display of chutzpah, President Obama actually asked the Iranians to return it. They said they'd be showing it to China and Russia. In fact, the only thing that might have brought a smile to the face of the president these days has been the almost daily comedy show provided by the would-be Republican candidates for his office. But Pakistan is an immediate problem and one that seems to be growing worse by the day, and that's what Takes on the World will be examining this morning about 20 minutes past the hour when I speak once again with Professor Pervez Hoodboy in Lahore, Pakistan. Before getting him on the phone, let's take a look at a story that is both global and local and one that I have been following on my last two programs. It concerns Walmart, the world's largest retailer and corporation whose quest for profits and market domination have proved to be insatiable. But it doesn't always get what it wants. Last week, as the Washington Post Rama Lakshmi reported, India's government bowed to 12 days of bitter opposition in Parliament and put on hold a government policy that would have allowed Walmart to open its superstores in India. The decision to open up India's $450 billion retail market to foreign companies has been bitterly debated for over a decade. When Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's coalition government announced his decision to welcome Walmart last month, he ran into opposition not only from opposition parties, but even from his own colleagues in the government and the ruling Congress party. They were responding to the thousands of small shop owners across India who protested on the streets, claiming that big retail stores like Walmart would wipe out their livelihoods, as they have done in similar circumstances in other countries, including our own, and our neighbor to the south, Mexico, being a prime example in India that they were listened to. We have yet to see such public protest against Walmart's proposed expansion in Ukiah by the markets and workers who will be impacted by it, but this Saturday, December 17th, at 11 a.m., there will be a nonviolent, non-confrontational protest by Occupy Walmart and Mendocino Solidarity on the grassy knoll overlooking the Walmart parking lot at the Airport Boulevard Shopping Center. Tonight, however, the two organizations are encouraging people to attend the meeting of the Ukiah Planning Commission at the Civic Center, 300 Seminary Drive. At that meeting, which will begin promptly at 6 p.m., the commission will vote on whether or not to approve the final environmental impact report on Walmart's proposal to expand its current 109,000 square foot facility by another 52,000 square feet and become a 24/7 full service grocery and liquor store. At its last meeting, November 9th, when the vote was originally scheduled to be taken, there was so much public comment, both for and against the Walmart expansion, that Chair Judy Pruden decided to continue the process until tonight. Although public comment has been closed regarding the environmental impact report, the Planning Commission must still approve a site development permit, which would allow Walmart to actually carry out the expansion, and there will be time for public comment on that. What is critical is that in order to approve the site development permit, the Commission must adopt a statement of quote-unquote, overriding considerations based on what the Commission acknowledges to be, quote, significant and unavoidable environmental effects, end quote, of the traffic at the 101 Talmadge Airport Boulevard interchange, which the Environmental Impact Report acknowledged, if understated. What is important is that the EIR admitted that there was no funding in the pipeline to mitigate the already existing traffic problem at that intersection, which would be greatly exacerbated by the Walmart expansion, as well as by the construction of a Costco further down the road at the same shopping center, which is next on the agenda for the Planning Commission to consider. In other words, in order to approve the site development permit, the Commission would have to agree, in essence, that allowing a Walmart to go through with its planned expansion is of more value to the city and people of Ukiah than the lives and safety of those who might be jeopardized by the traffic jams that will most certainly become a fact of life at that already perilous interchange should the permit be granted. Without taking an official position against the Walmart expansion, the County Board of Supervisors seems to agree. In its evaluation of the Environmental Impact Report sent to the Planning Commission a week ago Tuesday, the board wrote, quote, based on the understated existing level of service, the project impacts and mitigations seem to assume that the anticipated additional queuing backup will decrease the amount of the southbound off-ramp that is safely available for deceleration. In short, people exiting the freeway at Talmadge will have less time to brake. In fact, noted the board evaluation, the additional queuing backup generated by the project will increase the frequency and severity of queuing backups onto the freeway. It also found, quote, the discussion of the potential for the project to contribute to urban decay is superficial at best, end quote. That's not surprising given that another division of the firm which made the urban decay report, CBRE, the world's largest commercial realtor, just happens to be Walmart's real estate agent, as I reported, broke that story actually earlier here on Takes on the World. Although city planner Charlie Stump did not think that represented a conflict of interest, there were some on the board who apparently did, and Amy Herman, the person who was working for CBRE at the time and who made the report, was questioned about it on November 9th. While claiming that the consulting and real estate divisions were entirely separate, Herman was obliged to acknowledge they were paid from the same payroll. I should add that that was the consulting division's last job. They seem to have gone out of business since this issue came up. While the traffic problems that would be created by the Walmart expansion are indisputable, the effects that it would have on the existing Ukiah supermarkets and on the lives and futures of their workers are no less evident. The workers at Food Mats and Lucky, for example, the two markets most threatened by the Walmart expansion and likely to close, are unionized. Their workers earn higher wages and far greater benefits than the tight-fisted Waltons provide for what they call their associates, many of whom are paid so little that they are eligible for food stamps and Medicaid, something their Walmart supervisors encourage them to apply for, placing a further strain on the public services wherever any one of their stores exists. The struggle against Walmart's expansion is, of course, not unique to Ukiah. At any given moment across the country, there are similar public battles taking place which have been properly couched as a 99% resisting the corporate 1%. One of those places is Watertown, Massachusetts. An opponent of a Walmart opening in Watertown, Sonia Caval, as a spokesperson for what described itself as a socially responsible investing firm, wrote on Saturday, quote, while we are sympathetic about the need for job creation and low prices for consumers, we believe that Walmart's presence in a community does not achieve those goals over the long term. There have been many studies, she writes, that have shown that when Walmart enters a market, the net effect is to reduce local employment, reduce area wage rates and total payroll, and eliminate other businesses and raise poverty rates. Is this something that Watertown wants to pursue, she asks? We may ask the same of Ukiah. Walmart, she continues, has been implicated in a significant number of employee-related lawsuits, many of which have received class action status. The lawsuits have alleged violations of wage and hour laws, failure to pay overtime wages, forcing employees to work off the clock, discrimination, and illegal compensation. Moreover, Sonia Caval writes, Walmart continues to adopt contentious tactics to systematically prevent its employees from unionizing, including intimidation of union supporters and store closures where unionization efforts have succeeded, end quote. This is what the people of Ukiah and the county of Mendocino are up against as well. If you feel strongly about it, the place for you is at tonight's meeting in the Ukiah Planning Commission at 6 p.m. at 300 Seminary Drive in Ukiah, where there's plenty of parking and you can have your say. Well, determining our nation's foreign policy, as spelled out in the Constitution, is normally the responsibility of the president, with Congress's role limited to opening or closing the purse strings and declaring war. Since Israel declared itself a state in 1948, that has only rarely been the case when and where Israel has been concerned. For the last 20 years, since the first President Bush, who in September 1991 and again in February 1992 refused to approve $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel, and in doing so publicly challenged the pro-Israel establishment and their congressional lackeys, his successors in the White House have allowed Israel and its American agents to essentially write the script for U.S.-Israel relations and for not resolving the Israel-Palestine conflict. Mitt Romney has even bragged about letting Israel determine our Middle East policy should he be elected, while claiming that Obama has, quote, thrown Israel under the bus. Despite what those Republicans jousting among one another for a chance to contest him in 2012 may claim, no president has been more obliging to Israel in a material way than Barack Obama, which he demonstrated in the first months of his presidency by shipping bunker buster bombs at Tel Aviv, something that George W. Bush had refused to do. Those are the very weapons that Israel would need to damage Iran's nuclear facilities should it be insane and foolish enough to launch an airstrike against Tehran, which many media pundits in Israel and the U.S. expect them to do by early spring with Congress's full support. Nevertheless, Obama is in deep water with Israel and the Likudnik American Jewish establishment when, in the absence in the space of a few days, his Secretary of State, his Defense Secretary, and his ambassador to Belgium made statements that the Israeli camp there and here found offensive. The statements from both Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta came as a Saban form of the Brookings Institution in Washington a week and a half ago, an event funded by the Egyptian-born Israeli-American billionaire Haim Saban, who literally bought the Middle East program of the once prestigious Brookings Institution with a gift of $12.3 million. Saban, who has given more than $10 million to Hubby Bill's foundation, must not have been pleased to hear Secretary of State Clinton complain about the discrimination against women by ultra-Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem and New York, and raising the specter of Rosa Parks, singling out the fact that Jewish women at both places are forced to sit in the back of the bus. Clinton also complained about the reports of religious soldiers walking out of a concert rather than listen to women singers. She said that reminded her of the situation in Iran. Comparing Israel with Iran? That's a definite no-no. Following his own speech at the Saban Forum, Panetta was asked what steps Israel should take to get talks between Israel and the Palestinians underway again. What ABC described as, quote, a frustrated Panetta replied to applause, just get to the damn table, just get to the table, adding, quote, the problem right now is we can't get them to the same table to at least sit down and begin to discuss their differences, end quote. Blaming Israel even partially for the failure of the so-called peace talks? That's certainly another no-no. What capped the problem for the administration's pro-Israel critics was a comment made by Henry Gutmann, the U.S. ambassador to Belgium, at a meeting in Europe in which he separated the widespread anti-Jewish feelings among Muslims in the Middle East and elsewhere from the classic anti-Semitism of pre-World War II Europe, attributing their antipathy to Israel and to Jews to the situation of the Palestinians and the failure to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict. Blaming Jews for anti-Semitism? That was too much for Obama's Jewish critics. And despite not condoning what most of the civilized world considers to be an established fact, and despite Gutmann being the child of Holocaust survivors, there has been a widespread call for his firing from within the Jewish establishment, and as can be expected from both Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney, who are in competition for the largesse of Jewish donors. One of those, by the way, Sheldon Adelson, judged by Forbes to be the 8th richest American and the 16th richest person in the world, owning major hotels in Las Vegas and Macau. He publishes Chaim, Israeli Chaim, the most widely read paper in Israel. It's free. Well, he's also one of the biggest donors to right-wing Israeli causes, and donated $7 million to a foundation started by Gingrich, which the former House Speaker shut down when he decided to seek the presidency. That's right, $7 million. And Adelson's also a close friend and big supporter of Netanyahu. Ditto for Gingrich. So you can guess where he and Romney stand on supporting an Israeli attack on Iran and reaching any kind of agreement with the Palestinians. 2012 promises to be a dangerous year.